I'm turning now to the book of Job and chapter 13 and verse 15. Job chapter 13, verse 15. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him, but I will maintain mine own ways before him. He also shall be my salvation, for an hypocrite shall not come before him. We've been looking at the book of Job. Remember his witness. He's described in the opening verses of the book, effectively, as a saved man and as an admirable believer in the Lord. He doesn't know it, but as the result of that mysterious interaction which is described between Satan and God, Job is to be a living demonstration of the efficacy, the effectiveness of Christian conversion, of conversion to God. Satan believes that all who profess to be believers in God are hypocrites, and it isn't genuine. There's no such thing as a spiritual work in the heart, and they only believe because of what they think they get from God. And you remember the argument is, if everything were to be taken away from Job, all his benefits and his blessings, then he would curse God and he would turn from him. And first of all, he loses his family and his riches, his goods, and then ultimately his health. And he's in a state of desperate suffering. He doesn't deny his God. He does say many unworthy things because he cannot believe and understand why he should be in such a predicament and why it should be unrelieved. And he's visited by, and I mustn't spend long recapitulating, he's visited by three so-called friends. They appear to be, the language that's used about them gives the impression that they are his best friends, his most intimate and closest friends, which is very strange. Perhaps this is one of Job's mistakes, because they're not believers. In fact, they're very antagonistic to Job's doctrine of salvation. Job clearly, in his book, believes that man cannot rise to the perfections of God and satisfy God's holiness and God's demands, and he can only know God and be reconciled with God by an act of salvation or mercy, where he's freely forgiven and God pardons him and draws him near. Whereas the friends did not believe that. They were offended by that. They believed that their conduct was good enough. And so it wasn't possible to know God intimately or to really be associated with him. But their lives were good enough for them to be blessed and rich. Whereas Job, now he's suffering, well, to them, to the friends, the hostile friends, it's evidence that Job must have been a hypocrite. They believe in strict cause and effect. If there is a sad state of affairs such as that experienced by Job, it's because the person is under judgment. And so they move in for the kill, and they're highly critical of him. Here in this 13th chapter, as we proceed, a number of things. You see Job longing for vindication. Why has God done this to him? He doesn't know he's a demonstration of the effectiveness of salvation and of conversion to God. He doesn't know it. What's happening to him is to him a mystery. And so really, Job needs all his faith. And we cannot be critical of him because he is suffering very considerably. His suffering is immense. But at this time, he doesn't deny his God, but he does crack and he questions God's fairness to him. But here he has this moment of hope in chapter 13 and verses 15 and 16. Though he slay me, Yet will I trust in him. He won't give up his God. But I will maintain mine own ways before him. Now some people think he's saying there, I will insist that I don't deserve this punishment. But in the context, he's much more likely to be saying, I will insist that I don't understand my plight and my condition, but I am a child of God, and I am forgiven by him. Verse 16, it ties in with this, he also shall be my salvation. For an hypocrite, that's what the friends have accused Job of being, an hypocrite shall not come before him. But Job believes that he will. However, he promptly slips back into the same crying out to God for vindication. Verse 21, I'm going to go very quickly. Chapter 13, verse 21. Withdraw thine hand far from me, and let not thy dread make me afraid. And verse 22. Then call thou, and I will answer. Or let me speak, and answer thou me. So now he's remonstrating with God. Give me the opportunity to demand to know why I'm hit so hard and hurt so hard. Surely I should be able to defend myself, and I don't deserve this. I should know the reason for God withdrawing from me. Verse 24, wherefore hidest thou thy face and holdest me for thine enemy? Job is deeply concerned about these things. And then his lament turns into even deeper gloom when we go into chapter 14. Man that is born of a woman is of few days and full of trouble. But as you read this lament, you can think, Job is not really speaking the truth. This is how he sees it in his terrible plight and condition, but it isn't true. Man that is born of a woman is of few days and full of trouble. You may say to yourself, well, it sounds true to me. Yes, it does if you're painting very roughly the portrait of human existence, but you think of Job. Why, he was probably in his 50s when this great plight came upon him. And up until that time, he'd known amazing success and provision and lands and cattle and estates, family and influence and a testimony to others. He'd been very deeply blessed. And as the book goes on, he tells us, he records some of the sources of his great happiness. So it wasn't true for him. He should be saying, man that is born of a woman certainly has a great struggle, but having turned to the Lord, I've had 50 years of great happiness also. But when we get into a depressed state and condition, we don't see things in perspective, and we don't have proper balance, and we only see the gloom. And here is Job, a tremendous poet, carried away by his own power of language. Verse 2, he cometh forth like a flower and is cut down. He fleeth also as a shadow and continueth not. The poetry is haunting and faultless, but it's not true entirely. There's truth in it. And dost thou open thine eyes upon such an one, and bringest me into judgment with thee? He should be remembering the goodness of God to him and recounting that. That's a pastoral lesson for us. In times of dismay and disappointment and heartache and difficulty, don't just allow the unhappy things to go round and round in the head, but you owe praise to God. Call to mind, to get your balance, the gracious things, the marvellous things, the magnificent things. Job wasn't doing that. I very much hesitate to criticise Job. If I had had half the troubles that he had, I dread to think how quickly I'd crumble. So who are we to point the finger at Job? But nevertheless, there are lessons for us to learn, even from Job. But we have to be careful. Verse 4, who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? Not one. Man is a fallen creature. Are you expecting too much of me, Lord? He says, and he proceeds down through this 14th chapter. The lament becomes worse and worse. You get down to verse 7, and this is a theme he's expounded before in a previous chapter. For there is hope of a tree, if it be cut down, that it will sprout again, and that the tender branch thereof will not cease. Though the root thereof wax old in the earth, and the stock thereof die in the ground, yet through the scent of water it will bud and bring forth boughs like a plant. But man dieth and wasteth away. In my condition I'm dying, I shall go. There will be no life, no resurrection for me, Job goes on to say, and he says it very powerfully. Better to have been a tree, and there would be some future possibility of life. Does that mean Job doesn't believe in an afterlife? He doesn't believe in heaven? Oh no, he believes in it. He hints at it more than a dozen times throughout his laments. But he doesn't believe it's for him. He's like poor William Cowper. Do you believe in heaven? Newton said to Cowper. Yes, for everyone but me, he would say. And that's like Job. He thinks that because of his sufferings, he must be utterly rejected. So when you see statements that seem to deny an afterlife in Job, they refer to him and his view of himself. He certainly believed in an afterlife. But man dieth, verse 10, and wasteth away. Yea, man giveth up the ghost, and where is he? He's counting himself as an unregenerate man, and he's thinking along those lines. So it's a very gloomy chapter, and in verse 13 he effectively says, let me die. But in verse 14, you can see that he's struggling within himself. If a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change come. Thou shalt call, and I will answer thee. Thou wilt have a desire to the work of thy hands. So he's vacillating. He's one moment he's given up hope, the next moment he seems to say, it cannot be. If I die and I'm bound for death, I shall live again, surely. So he hasn't entirely given up hope. So the lessons in this chapter or two are, it's too easy to think gloomily and to lapse into thoughts and assessments of life that are just utterly untrue and unrealistic. And here and there, you get elements of hope where Job suddenly will say, I will trust him no matter what. Will a man live again? Surely he will. But he lets them slip. He doesn't hold on to them. Again, I hesitate to be critical of Job, but by way of lesson for us, if you pass into a down mood or a depressed condition, and you have a good thought, and a scriptural thought, and a comfort, and a doctrine, don't let it slip. It's for you. Hold on to these promises and these vital texts. And remember them. But in Job's lament, they're overpowered by the sad language of the poem, and they're drowned and swept away. And that's a shame. So there's a pastoral lesson there for us. The constant rehearsal of woes, even if you can do it as beautifully as Job, is actually the practicing of antifaith. So be very careful with that flow of thoughts. Now it brings me to another heading in chapter 15. It's back to Eliphaz on the attack. And he sees Job now as an enemy of God. Every cycle of speeches, the language becomes more hostile. Verse 1, then answered Eliphaz the Temanite and said, should a wise man utter vain knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? And he says a number of antagonistic, outspoken things, accusing Job in verse 5 of self-justification, for thy mouth uttereth thine iniquity. The more you talk, the more you can hear your wickedness. And thou choosest the tongue of the crafty. And he accuses Job in verse 7. Art thou the first man that was born? Or wast thou made before the hills? Hast thou heard the secret of God? And dost thou restrain wisdom to thyself? What knowest thou that we know not? What understandest thou which is not in us? What's got into Eliphaz? We hear this language these days. People will say to a Bible believer, to an evangelical, you people, you think you have a monopoly of truth. And they will attack us in language like that. Well, I'll tell you what the problem was. If you have heard previous studies, Job had completely knocked for six the entire doctrine of Eliphaz and Bildad. And it disproved it from the world of nature and from human society, and he'd shown what nonsense it was. Just very briefly, the whole idea that if a man lives a reasonably good life, then he is rewarded by God. And if he's punished, it proves that he's lived a bad life. Simple cause and effect. And Job had rehearsed a long sequence of how all the crooks and robbers in the world prosper, and they hadn't considered that, and how even in the animal kingdom, the most ferocious predators prosper on it, and so on. He'd completely demolished their foolish way of thinking. And they've got no answer for him, so they can only be rude. You think you have a monopoly of the truth. You think you're the only person who knows anything. You think you're the only one with wisdom. They can't really answer him, but they won't accept being straightened out. And that's what's going on in chapter 15 with this very hostile reaction of Eliphaz. And he brings in his low standard of righteousness again in verse 14. What is man that he should be clean before God, that is? And he which is born of a woman, that he should be righteous? God doesn't expect perfection. And our level of righteousness is more than enough for God. That's his implication. And then he proceeds in the rest of chapter 15 to accuse Job, of fighting against God all his life. And it's rather fascinating. Some of the descriptions here, verse 20. The wicked man travelleth with pain all his days, and the number of years is hidden to the oppressor. A dreadful sound is in his ears. In prosperity, the destroyer shall come upon him. And I'm not going to read all the verses, but he develops this, and actually there's a lot of truth in it. And the theory is that an extremely wicked person is a person who is almost driven by the fact that this liberty to sin may not last long, and my deeds may catch up with me, or I may lose my health or my opportunity. And while I can, I've got to try and get away with what I can. And they fix Job into such a description? To have suffered like you suffer, Job, you must be not only a hypocrite, but one of these people like that, driven further and further into sin and duplicity. They bring no evidence, but driven into your foul deeds, whatever they are, by the fear that you may be stopped at some time, and you may have to face up and give an account. And that's the development of the poem in chapter 15. Job is a non-stop offender and hypocrite. You come to chapter 16, and I'm racing through these mid-chapters. Then Job answered and said, and here's another thing. Job is going to say here, if our roles were reversed, I wouldn't behave as you behave. I would try to help you and edify you and comfort you. Then Job answered and said, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are ye all. Shall vain words have an end? Verse 4, I also could speak as ye do. If your soul were in my soul's stead, I could heap up words against you and shake mine head at you. But I wouldn't do that, he says. I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the moving of my lips should assuage your grief. And he tries to soften his friends by saying if roles were reversed, he would try and bring them spiritual comfort and profit. And they haven't attempted to do that at all. But then, coming back to, chapter 17, you get a theme coming in which is developed more as the book goes on, which gives us another pastoral lesson. Chapter 17, Job's response, my breath is corrupt, my days are extinct, the graves are ready for me. Are there not mockers with me? Doth not mine eye continue in their provocation? Only death is ahead. But then in verse 6, he opens this theme. He hath made me also a byword of the people, and aforetime I was as a tabret. And the meaning of this verse is that now people disparage him and speak against him and reject him. The one who was as a tabret, which probably means a pleasant musical instrument, one who, when his voice was raised, they all listened, and they enjoyed his humour and his instruction. But now he's just an object of criticism. And he feels this very deeply, and you can see his public rejection as you go through some of these words. And I'll pick it up, this theme, a little more later on. I'm coming on to chapter 18. Then answered Bildad the Shuhite, how long will it be ere ye make an end of words? Mark, and afterwards we will speak. And Bildad is going to be very bitter and on the attack against Job, full of indignation. And really, in this chapter, all he has to say is, you trap yourself, Job. There's an early death for you. It's unavoidable. Only fear of what is bound to come to you gives you this energy to defend yourself. You'll never be remembered. You'll be extinguished entirely, and you'll be chased out of the world by God and all your family and all your friends, and everybody will be glad to be rid of you. That's really the essence of the chapter. And in verse 21 of chapter 18, surely such are the dwellings of the wicked, and this is the place of him that knoweth not God. Absolute sentence pronounced over Job. Well, we come down and we bring our study to conclusion in this chapter. We come to chapter 19. Job answered and said, "How long will you vex my soul and break me in pieces with words?" Down to verse 5. "If indeed you will magnify yourselves against me and plead against me, my reproach." That's what they were doing. Puffing themselves up. "We've been right in our doctrine all along, Job. And you've been wrong in telling us we needed to be converted." That's really what it amounts to. And then in verse 8, Job complains that God hath fenced up my way that I cannot pass, and he hath set darkness in my paths. I can't see why he's doing this to me. God has unaccountably thrown me down, and I'm the disdain of all. Verse 13, "He hath put my brethren far from me, and mine acquaintance are verily estranged from me. My kinsfolk have failed, my familiar friends have forgotten me. They that dwell in mine house and my maids count me for a stranger, they snub me. I am an alien in their sight. I called my servant, and he didn't reply. I entreated him with my mouth," and so on. It sounds as though Job's former elevated position had meant a little too much to him. And in his suffering, it's a particular pain that he's lost all that. But when you come down to verse 23, you have an amazing moment of comfort and light. And these are verses you'll be familiar with. Right out of the blue, you might say, in verse 23, "Oh, that my words were now written. Oh, that they were printed in a book." Of course, the Hebrew doesn't say any such thing. Our translators are trying to help us. There were no books in those days, and there was certainly no printing. So this is a rare case of high dynamic equivalence in the King James Version. "Oh, that my words were now engraven in a rock," is more the sense. And it's repeated in verse 24, that they were graven with an iron pen and led in the rock forever. What is he talking about? Well, he's given a thought, clearly by God, which suddenly overwhelms him. It takes all the breath out of him, and all his complaints are momentarily forgotten. And he realizes this is so deep and so significant, he's got to study it himself. This is a communication from the Most High. It's something to be recorded. And that's exactly what's happened. It's been recorded for all time. "Oh, that my words were now written, graven with an iron pen, and led in the rock forever." What words are these? Well, I'll tell you what some of the liberal commentators say. These words that suddenly came crystal clear to Job, say the liberal commentators, and even some very, I believe, I'm afraid, foolish evangelicals in the study Bibles, and they say, "Oh, plainly, what Job is talking about is his words of self-justification, his insistence that he doesn't deserve such punishment. Oh, that my self-justification were to be engraven in a rock, so that I will be vindicated constantly in the coming years." But that's an obvious misinterpretation, because the words that are to be graven in the rock are the words of the thoughts that follow. That's so very plain. "For I know that my Redeemer liveth." These are the words. This is what was given to Job. The deep, deep certainty, the absolute certainty that he had a Redeemer. The great redemption work, that there was a propitiation made somehow for sin. He's not told how. The ransom word is used. As for the ransom that is paid when a prisoner is purchased out of captivity, if somebody of your family has been captured and you buy them back, and with that payment you assuage the assumed rights of the person who seized your relative and buy your relative back. I know that my Redeemer, the one who purchases me, the one who propitiates before God for me, what a realization. Within the Godhead, there is a member of the Godhead who will make a propitiation, offer a ransom to the Father for me, purchase me for his everlasting possession. Job is a deep thinker. He's going to have to think this out. But he knows this much, that that mysterious Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth, in the last age or in the last day. In other words, he will take a human form and he will be visible. God is invisible, but there is a member of the Godhead who will become visible so that those he redeems can see him and love him. And he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body in the ground, yet in my flesh I'm going to be raised again. Bodily, not just in spirit, but bodily. And I shall see God. Everything is there that's so profound. The incarnation of Christ, his atoning death, the resurrection of the body, a redemption, satisfaction, payment for sinners. The mind of Job is filled with this realization that there is one who is his divine Redeemer, who he will one day see at the end of the journey. The great kindness of God. He has bitterly cried out to God, "Explain this to me. Explain this to me." God hasn't yet explained it, but he's given him more than everything he needs to know. One day, you'll be resurrected and you'll see your Redeemer. Hold on to that and you can go through anything. You can be held up through anything. Because the friends, they see before their eyes faith in the invisible. And it doesn't make the slightest impression on them. They don't understand Job's words. They don't appreciate their depth and meaning. It goes right over their heads. But for Job, if he can only get hold of that and keep it, and that's what we're called to do. The eternal hope of the believer, and to keep it alive and to hold on to it. That's enough for us this evening.